yourself a song to sing, and sing it till you're done. Yes, sing it hard and sing it well. Send the robber barons straight to hell. The greedy thieves who came around and ate the flesh of everything they found, whose crimes have gone unpunished now, walk the streets a screaming now.
Greetings, all you 99 percenters. This is your host, Dr. Jack Rasmus. Good to be back after an absence of last week. Okay, let's dive right into it here. What is the major event or events of the past week, economically, U.S. and globally? And then on to talking about financial transaction taxes and the Sanders program and funding of single-payer health care, i.e., a.k.a. Medicare for All, a term I prefer to single-payer. And we'll talk about that at some length and the debate going on among neoliberal economists and progressive economists. Neoliberals, of course, are attacking Sanders and his proposals with a vengeance, very aggressively, now that some of his ideas are gaining traction. So we'll end the show with a discussion of Sanders, single-payer, financial transaction taxes, and neoliberal economists like Krugman and others on the offensive. But first, let's look at the week that was. Okay, and a couple of weeks ago, we talked about the very important decision by the European Central Bank. Remember that? This dueling QEs, quantitative easing, going on between Japan and Europe. The European Central Bank and Bank of China, tit for tat, as they both try to drive down their currency rates and stimulate exports and stimulate their stock markets, and try desperately to get growth going that way while they're filling the pockets of bankers and financial investors still further. You know, that's always been the strategy. Top-down, fill the coffers of the speculators and the financial investors first, and the bankers and shadow bankers, and maybe they'll dribble a little bit over into the real economy that might create some jobs and some economic growth. Of course, that's not working. Hasn't been working for a couple of years now, and increasingly not working. These kind of monetary central bank injections aren't even boosting the stock markets very much for very long in those two weakest sections of the global world economy, Japan and Europe. Little bit more and more bang for less and less buck. So what we got is a problem here with monetary policy that they're all beginning to realize is becoming counterproductive, and it's not generating the results that they want, even for their wealthy elites. And they're in a quandary. What are they going to do next? You know, Japan is so perplexed, and their policy has been such a gross failure that they're even talking to liberal economists now. Yeah, Joseph Stiglitz called over there. Shinzo Abe's cabinet and economists are talking to Stiglitz, and Stiglitz is telling them, look, you know, monetary policy is not working. Oh, big revelation. Talking to them about stimulating fiscally. Well, we'll see what happens with that. And even Paul Krugman, which I'll have something more to say, is talking, invited over and is talking to his counterparts in the administration over there, singing the same tune. But we'll see what Japan does. I don't believe the bankers will listen to any fiscal stimulus. The best that they may do over there in Japan is to suspend the next tax hike on consumers, average consumers. You know, the last tax hike in 2014 sent their economy into a recession, and they temporarily, once again for the fifth time, recovered, and then last year went into a recession again, and we're going to see they're still in it. So if you want to see where this whole neoliberal monetary policy central bank liquidity injection policy has failed abysmally. It's in Japan, and it's almost with an abysmal failure in Europe. And as we talked about last week, 2 weeks ago, the ECB, European Central Bank for the Eurozone, did a tit-for-tat following the Japanese and went deeper into negative rates, negative interest rates, negative 0.4%, and buying corporate bonds, not just government bonds. Now the ECB, with this new policy, will actually be paying banks, European banks, to lend. Yeah, they're subsidizing. They're paying banks to lend. And it's going to have no real effect on the real economy over there. We have a little bit of a temporary stock surge in Germany, France, but it will be temporary, more temporary than the previous one. Very, very little loan, real lending by private banks going on, even under the old program. And the new program coming won't do any better. Interest rates have been 0%. In other words, companies can borrow from banks in Europe at 0% as a result of ECB massive injections and up to now. And of course, now we got another massive injection coming. Even the old ones have not had any effect, you know. So I guess the idea is if the policy doesn't work, double down. That's the logic of all this. If it's broke, break it some more. And throw more money at the banks and investors. Yeah, even zero loans. Only 19 of 300 banks have been borrowing from the ECB. Less than half of the limit that the ECB said before it was going to lend out is being taken up by the private banks, because the private banks aren't lending. German-French banks are full of excess liquidity, and they're not lending. Or you could conversely say the economic conditions are so bad that non-bank companies don't want to borrow. Why would you borrow money and expand when you can't sell what you got now? Doesn't make sense. All this money supply focus of mainstream economists is nonsense, because it ignores the demand for funds, money demand. I mean, you can pump all the money you want into the economy, and if economic conditions are so poor that no one wants to borrow it, well, what good is all that excess liquidity? It just sits there, or it goes into stock markets, bond markets, financial speculation. And that's been the story since 2009. Okay? And it's still the story in Europe. So pumping more money into the economy is not going to do anything in Europe to the real economy. It'll give some boost to the stock market, which is doing. And it will maybe even lower the currency. But there's so many different forces at play in the global currency markets and global trade that devaluing your currency by monetary injection won't get you very much for very long. It will be quickly offset by others. By the way, there was news in that regard of the G20, you know, the big 20 economies of the world, representatives getting together in China in recent weeks and trying to figure out how they can stop this competitive devaluation by monetary QE injection by central banks. You know, they're all trying to beggar their neighbor and get a little bit of share increase of the shrinking global trade export pie. At the expense of each other. These are called competitive devaluations. You know, I lower my currency by injecting, my central bank injecting excess money into the economy, and that gives my currency a little bit of a drop and a little bit of a cost advantage for exports vis-a-vis other countries. But since everybody can do that, they do that, and that advantage that's gained quickly dissipates. It doesn't last very long. So they got together here in China not too long ago, a couple of weeks ago, and try and figure out how they're going to do that. And the central bankers come to the agreements, we're not going to engage in competitive devaluations, you know. And maybe Japan will hold off from doing so in response to the Europeans. Maybe this dueling QEs, monetary injections, we'll have a bit of a hiatus here. We'll see. And, you know, it's probably why the U.S. Central Bank's decision recently was not to raise rates. This is tied into the whole picture. You know, these central banks everywhere are trying to come up with a coordinated solution, and they're not able to do it. And they're sort of feeling their way. It's a very tentative period here in terms of policy, as monetary policy clearly shows it's breaking down. And we will see what happens with that. But, you know, I don't believe that they'll be able to coordinate. You know, clearly the U.S. Fed's decision not to raise rates was predicated on trying to slow down the crisis in emerging markets economies. And, you know, because every time the dollar rises, interest rates, U.S. interest rates rise, the dollar rises even further. Long term, it continues to rise, but short term rates, the Federal Reserve can have some effect on. But raising rates short term or long term, every time that happens, you know, the money flows out of emerging markets, and emerging markets are in a big funk, Brazil, elsewhere. And that's why Obama's running around Latin America right now. I'm sure he's telling them of ways they will support them economically, Argentina and others, if Argentina and others do the U.S. bidding again, now that they're overturning the governments down there, the U.S. Overturning governments indirectly behind the scenes. Okay. So fallout from the European Central Bank, right? Even though they're buying corporate bonds and lowering negative interest rates and paying banks to borrow, banks still aren't loaning. They're taking the money and they're not loaning. You know, sit on the money. Take the money from the European Central Bank. They'll pay you for it. Sit on it. It's better than loaning it out, maybe. Safer. Anyway, well, continuing our round robin here, what's going on with the junk bond situation in the U.S.? Ooh, it's getting worse, right? Energy, oil and gas, energy junk bonds, high yield bonds, risky bonds, right? A lot of these companies are going bankrupt already. 51 companies have filed for bankruptcy in the oil patch in the U.S. And 175 are at high risk, right? Even though oil prices have risen a little bit, you know, they hit a low of $26 a barrel in January. They're up to about 40 now. Mm-hmm. For these oil and gas companies, fracking companies, so forth, their debt as a percent of their market value has risen, has doubled over the past year. Right, 50% of their market value. Debt is 50% of their market value. Well, a lot more of them are going to go under. And there's a big risk, as we've always said, and as I wrote about in my book, Identifying Financial Risk Areas, in my book, Systemic Fragility of the Global Economy, available on Amazon and on my website, and my blog, jackrasmus.com. You know, as I predicted there, this is a highly unstable, fragile area. The junk bond market, of which about a fifth of it is energy junk bonds, and if we have a massive collapse of the energy junk bond market here in the U.S., it could easily drag down the rest of the junk bonds. You know, we're talking about multi-trillions of dollars here, and who knows where that contagion goes to. The only thing that's putting off this further collapse in this energy junk bond market is the fact that they've been able to engineer a little bit of an increase in the oil price. As I said, it was $26. Now it's up to about $40. And that's primarily because there's been a preliminary agreement to freeze oil prices, global crude oil prices, at January levels, as a result of meetings between Russia, Venezuela, Saudi Arabia, Qatar, and a few others. They've agreed that they haven't done it yet, but they've agreed to do that. But just that possibility has convinced some global oil speculators. And the price of oil is right now, all this fluctuation volatility is all speculative. It has nothing really to do with supplies and demand, which are longer-term forces here. This short-term up and down is really all about global speculators in oil, because oil is a financial security, not just a commodity, a physical commodity. And the speculators drive the financial security price, therefore the price of oil itself. You know, it's just like mortgage bonds and housing back, a decade ago. A lot of the price of mortgage bonds and so forth were going through the roof, and all the derivatives based upon them. But that was all speculative activity, buying and selling of the securities based upon the housing industry. Well, you got the same thing going in crude oil and all commodities. And this is all part of the financialization of the commodity, I mean, of the global economy now. All of these real assets have financial security reflections or representations, and it's the buying and selling and speculating in the price of these securities that's making the global financial economy so unstable. But that's part of its characteristic now. You know, it's a globally financialized system, capitalism is, because it's so easy to make profits on securities price volatility up and down, far easier and quicker than it is to actually make things and sell them, you know, and then you got to get a sales force, and you got cost of goods, and you got to, employ workers and so forth, and everything, you know, and you got competitors and distribution channels. It's all very expensive, but buying and selling financial securities is a quick way to make a lot of money, and the big investors are all moving in that direction. I talk about that at some length in my book about the financial asset investing shift going on in the global finance capital elite behind it all. 200,000 big investors, mostly in the U.S. and Europe, but growing in Asia, who have income flows every year of $25 million. That's income flows, not assets. You can imagine the kind of asset levels you've got to have to generate $25 million in income flows from those assets every year, okay? The shadow banks are their preferred investment institutions because they are largely unregulated, and they can make the big bets and the big risks and so forth with those institutions, and they create all these financial products to do it with, and move their money around. It's highly liquid, et cetera, et cetera. That's chapter 12 and 13 in my book, Systemic Fragility in the Global Economy. That's the key to understanding what's going on here. But your mainstream economists, they don't pay any attention to that. You know, they're still myopically preoccupied with their models, economic models from the 1930s and 40s and 50s that have no financial variables to speak of involved in those models, and that's why they can't understand the volatility of what goes on. And that includes liberals like Paul Krugman and others. Well, you know, they're not really liberals anymore. I'm going to talk about that. They are neoliberals. Just as the Democratic Party has morphed into a neoliberal wing of the global corporate party of America, their mouthpieces, their economic mouthpieces like Krugman and others are now really, truly neoliberals. I mean, look, you know, he's a big champion of free trade. He's a champion of lower central banks interest rates, you know, which give investors free money by the trillions, but which prevent retirees and mom and pop seniors, fixed income and interest rates. They have, you know, $50 million in the U.S. You know, they're not earning anything anymore on their savings. All that is part of neoliberalism. Yeah, let's be in favor of the central bank lowering rates and pumping more money into financial institutions and investors, and at the same time, the average folks can't earn anything on their CDs or saving accounts or anything anymore. So you're just transferring money from them to the rich speculators. But that's Krugman's policy, and Krugman still believes in this nonsense about free trade. He's a big free trader, made his name in the 90s, champion free trade under Bill Clinton. So these folks, these economists are no longer liberals. That's a euphemism or whatever. They're not liberals. They're neoliberals. Neoliberals. And they use this model, this old model that's decades old and why it keeps missing. I'll be talking about that when I talk about their attacks on Bernie Sanders and financial transaction taxes and so forth here later in the show. But let's go on with the overview. China. Let's look at China. What's going on here? China's the biggest indebted country in the world, worse than Greece, 230% of GDP, but it's sitting on, well, it had $4 trillion of currency reserves. That's down to about $1 trillion because it's spending like water to prop up the stock market and to prevent a capital flight out of the country. It's committing huge amounts of those reserves. I think they're close to $3 trillion. They've committed over $1 trillion. And we've had $1 trillion of capital flight out of the country last year. And it remains the same whether that flow continues. Most of the run-up in the debt in China the last 5 years has been corporate debt, $25 trillion in corporate debt. Yeah, massive, massive corporate debt. By the way, I have a chapter dedicated just to China in my book, Systemic Fragility, called Bubbles, Toils, and Troubles. Yeah, a little Shakespearean Macbeth thing there, right? Okay. Corporate debt, as I said, $25 trillion. A lot of it go into old line industrial companies, manufacturing companies, mining companies, steel companies, and so forth. Bad debt, a huge amount of bad debt. In other words, of that $25 trillion loans, even J.P. Morgan Chase has estimated 7% of all their loans are non-performing. In other words, non-performing means they're not paying principal and interest. They're not paying anything at all. They're just sitting there accumulating additional interest. 7% of that $25 trillion. Well, I don't know. Figure that out. How much is that? You know, it's almost $2 trillion, isn't it? 7% non-performing loans. Actually, other estimates I've seen are $3.5 trillion or $5 trillion non-performing loans. It depends what source you're looking at, you know, whether they want to downsize the estimate or not. And Europe has like $1.5 trillion in non-performing loans. You know, this is all sitting on bank balance sheets, and they're not reporting. In China, they hardly report this stuff. You know, it's hard to even see it. They keep it really covered up. Might be even worse. So what's China trying to do? It's trying to engineer what's called debt for equity swaps, or equity for debt swaps. What is that? Well, corporations get rid of their bad debt by turning it into stocks, equity, right? Equity of stocks, and selling stocks, converting the debt, the loans and the bond debt to stock swaps. Well, you know, people are going to have to want to buy stocks for those bad companies to be able to do that, or else the government has to buy the stock. And, you know, average investors, retail investors in China are a little bit burned by the stock market crash there that occurred last year. That crash, of course, has been stabilized at a lower level now. As a result of the government pumping massive liquidity into the economy to stop it, and giving loans, direct loans to broker dealers, shadow bankers who are involved in the buying and selling, trading of stock, right? Trying to securitize some of the loans here. There's a trial going on to securitize, and I always take these bad loans and chop them up and sell them. That's what securitization was in 2007-08 that led to a lot of the crash in the global housing industry. Well, they're going that route again to trying to securitize. They're experimenting with that. And they're creating, allowing a new housing bubble in China to emerge. So that, you know, those folks in China selling off their stock have a place to put it in China instead of sending it abroad. That's, you know, they're trying to prevent this capital flight as the sell-off occurs in the stock market there. And, you know, they're given an opportunity, well, reinvest in rising housing prices again, folks. You remember that bubble? On and off bubble in China? And they're trying to stimulate more stock buying in China, and by returning to what's called margin buying. allow people to borrow money to buy stocks. Well, that was, you know, one of the big reasons why the stock bubble occurred and then crashed. So the Chinese are reverting to solutions to deal with the financial instability and capital flight that caused the original financial instability and capital flight. In that regard, they're no different than the rest of the world is doing the same thing. But it's only going to lead to even worse developments with a time lag. They're just buying time, you see. So China, you know, we got this whack-a-mole financial instability situation. You know, a financial bubble emerges here, and they whack it, and it merges over there in the stock market. They whack it, and it merges over here in corporate bond loans. They whack it, and so forth. It just keeps moving around because you're not getting rid of the excess liquidity. You're just moving the liquidity and the debt around from one sector to the other. You're not getting rid of it. You can't get rid of it. It's still there. It's like treating a cancer in one part of your body and stimulating it in another. So you just keep moving on. Whack-a-mole financial policies, as I call it. Interesting, too, in China, one last comment on that, is they are planning to tax currency transactions. Ooh, a financial transaction tax on currency. Well, that's designed to discourage speculation in the yuan, you see. The Chinese, have agreed with the rest of the G20 that they're not going to allow their currency, the yuan, to depreciate too much further. It's at its limit right now for range they've set up. Because if they do, if the Chinese yuan depreciates further, which it did just a little bit last August and set off a global firestorm of devaluation, if they do that, it's just going to be a signal for everybody else devalue. And now we're on this even a greater competitive wheel, devaluation treadmill. You know, China jumps into that dueling devaluations, dueling QEs, then it's really financial instability time. So that's it for China here. I mentioned about Krugman and Stiglitz meeting with Japanese Prime Minister Abe and his folks to get a different view, because clearly the Japanese are at a loss. They don't know what to do and don't know what policies next to introduce here. And they're even desperately listening to some neoliberals who are saying you've got to stimulate the fiscal side, you know, some investing in infrastructure. You know, that's their big thing, invest in financial infrastructure, and somehow that's going to provide the stimulus. You see, the problem with mainstream economics is, and the whole liberal neoliberal point of view, is that if you just throw fiscal spending into the economy, the volume magnitude of spending is all that matters. Their models are broken because their models only show, you know, $100 billion of this will get you a $150 billion of GDP increase, regardless how the $100 billion is spent. You know, I mean, you can put it in unemployment insurance increases. You know, you can use it on infrastructure or whatever. But I've argued for some time that it matters how you spend that $100 billion of additional investment in the economy. And I am reluctant to believe that a big, massive fiscal spending on infrastructure, you know, bills, roads, bridges, roads, etc., is going to have that big bang a buck in the economy and general economy, because these are projects that are longer term, many of them. And we saw that in 2009. You know, part of the $787 billion Obama stimulus package, $100 billion was on long-term investment projects. Well, the long-term investment projects take a long time to have an effect, and they can be distorted and stopped easily after a period of time, which is what they typically do. And they have no effect on the economy. And that was true with the $100 billion that Obama agreed to spend back then. hasn't had much effect on the U.S. economy. And infrastructure spending, I don't believe, will have some effect. And even within infrastructure itself, you know, what kind of infrastructure are you talking about? And how quick and how many jobs will it generate and how quick will it have an effect? You could have a very capital-intensive, not a lot of job creation projects, which won't help the economy very much. Okay. The other thing, development we've been following, we're talking about is labor market restructuring and reforms in France, right? French labor market reforms. This is all part of this European drive here to supplement devaluation, currency devaluation, to stimulate exports, reduce costs, in other words, for European companies so that they can reduce price and compete more effectively globally. Well, the other way is reducing wages and benefits, you see. That reduces company cost. In Spain, the right-wing government has followed that very successfully. Exports have risen. The Spanish economy has recovered a little bit, but none of that has gotten to the Spanish worker, none. In fact, it's worse because they've lowered wages as the way of doing this. Right? So it benefits exporting companies and capitalists, but it doesn't benefit the workers at all and real incomes. This is a push throughout Europe, labor market restructuring and reforms, as they call it, which is really a cover phrase for let's reduce wages and benefits and reduce costs of production as a result. France, of course, has a so-called socialist government, as they say, has been trying to implement, to push this policy of labor market reforms, and they were able to announce about a month ago a major program of labor market restructuring, which would allow corporations to lay people off, to fire them and lay people off, because in France and most of Europe, corporations have to disprove, or prove rather, why they had a reason to lay them off, to dismiss people, and workers have a right to go to courts to dispute and argue to the contrary. And it's hard to lay full-time workers off in Europe because of these rights. Part-time workers don't have the rights, and that's why in France and elsewhere in Europe, all the hiring has been part-time, what we call contingent workers, temporary part-time workers, a big trend globally, capitalism everywhere, including this country, right? You know, 90% of everyone hired in the last several years in France have been part-time, contingent, 90%. You know, the employers are getting around it and gaming it by not hiring any full-time people. And labor market reforms are all designed to give them the employers, the same right to manipulate full-time workers. Eliminate these courts where layoffs can be challenged. You know, that's a big proposal here. And allow companies to cut employment and to lower wages without having to go to court to defend it, you see. The French government, Hollande government, says, oh, this is a way, if we do this, make it easier for employers to lay off and cut wages and hours of full-time workers, then they'll hire more full-time instead of all this hiring of contingent, right? There's no guarantee that'll happen. They'll take away the benefits, protections, and rights of full-time, and they'll still keep hiring part-time, you see? That's the convoluted logic here that's not being expressed. Unemployment's still 10% in France and Europe. It hasn't come down at all. There's been no real growth in Europe and France, you know, since 2008. They've been in and out of recessions and stagnation and so forth, despite pumping $5-6 trillion at least, the central bank, into these banks and into these companies, which haven't resulted in any real job growth or any real wage growth. Okay, so that's the situation. And by the way, the only reason they've backed off a little bit of these labor market reforms in France is that there have been massive demonstrations all over France by workers and students against this. So they got a little worried, the policymakers in the French government, ersatz socialist government, and they retreated a little bit, but they retreated only partially. They're still proposing labor market reforms that allow large companies, multinational companies, greater ease in layoffs and cutting of hours of workers, right? Greater ease. It's not, the less politically connected smaller companies, they backed off of giving them that right. Most of them are hiring part-time anyway, but now they want to give the multinational corporations. So it's a partial backup as a result of mass demonstrations in France on labor market reforms. Okay, just a couple other things about the U.S. economy here. Report come out that average prescription drug prices have increased 100% in the last 5 years. That's 20% a year growth. That's the average, you see. There's a lot of drugs that haven't increased at all, those that people don't use, or there's lots of generics for. But the drugs that people really need desperately, and there's no generics for, these have increased by hundreds and thousands of percent. So you get an average of a doubling of drug prices, right? This is a big problem in the U.S. Politicians are given backhanded support to doing something about it, but they're not going to say what they're going to do, which is a signal that they're going to do nothing, in my opinion. And then the final thing about the U.S. economy here, U.S. millennials, millennials 25 to 34 years old, who are taking the brunt of this slow economy and this poor recovery. Well, not poor for the 1%. The 1% have gained 97% of all the income, additional net increase in income since 2009. 97% of it have gone to the wealthiest 1%. 97% to the 1%. Right? Talk about income inequality, and it's accelerating. It's getting worse. Under George Bush, it was 65% of all the net income gains during his term going to the wealthiest 1%. And during under Bill Clinton in the 90s, it was 48%. So it's getting worse. 48, 65, 97 of all the net income gains. It's their economy. We only work here, you see. We only work and live here. It reminds me of that movie, The Good Shepherd. You ever see The Good Shepherd? Go see it. Matt Damon, he's a CIA agent, and he sits down with, I forget the guy's name, Big Shot, Meyer Lansky, in the Mafia, right, U.S. Mafia, and they sit down there and they're talking, and Meyer Lansky says, why are you in this? The Italians have their family, the blacks have their culture, their music, and so on and so forth. All these different ethnic groups have something. And Lansky asks Matt Damon, the CIA big shot, out of Yale. He asks him, what do you have? And Matt Damon answers, we have the United States of America. The rest of you just work here. Wow. What a statement, Sums it up, doesn't it? Yeah, we just work here, work for them, work here, and they have the country. It's their country. Okay, so with that leads us nicely into the elections, right? I promised to say something about Sanders and financial transaction taxes. And paying for single-payer health care. Well, recently, in the last few weeks, since the end of February, there's been a big debate among economists here. This progressive economist, Gerald Freeman, came out and did an analysis based upon the old model of the neoliberals, or the liberal economists, that showed that Sanders' proposals would have a very positive effect on the U.S. economy. So Paul Krugman jumps in and attacks him. Of course, Krugman, you know, columnist in New York Times, strongly behind Hillary Clinton. And so is Paul. And Paul is not a liberal economist. He's a neoliberal economist. As I said earlier, espouses free trade, you know, made his name, and got himself an award there, you know, Nobel Prize for it, and showing how free trade benefited everybody. Yeah, what nonsense. But anyway, that's the holy grail of mainstream economics, free trade, and all that nonsense about free trade. I'm not going to go into how easy it is to refute this whole idea of free trade. But, you know, he made his name there, and he's been espousing ever since. And, of course, you read his columns, he's very much for keeping interest rates low, which means benefiting financial investors and bankers at the expense of grandma and grandpa savings. You know, he's a neoliberal now. We should call these people what they are. They're neoliberals, and the Democratic Party is a neoliberal party. It's, you know, there isn't two parties in this country. There's one corporate party of America with two wings, the Republican wing and the Democratic wing. But their policies are really not that different, and they really end up filling the coffers, you know, of the wealthy 1%. In different ways, but filling them nonetheless, you see. And all you need to do is look at the facts of the conservative approach under George Bush, 65% going to 1%, and the, quote, Democratic approach under Barack Obama, 97%. Okay, it's, you know, the proof is in the numbers, in the final outcomes here of their economic programs. You know, they've been attacking, Krugman's been attacking Sanders, and he attacks them through, he jumped into this fray by attacking this other economist, Gerald Friedman, out of the University of Massachusetts. And Friedman is also, by the way, a Hillary supporter, but he used Friedman, Paul Krugman used Friedman as a foil to attack Sanders, and attacked it, you know, in a very uneconomic sort of way, asserting that anybody who believes Sanders' proposals, you know, are stupid and only economists like him know better. In other words, trying to use his position as an economics big shot in order to attack Sanders' ideas. And, of course, at the heart of Sanders' ideas. By the way, let me back up. If you want to read a sort of running commentary of this ivory tower debate, go to New Economic Perspectives blog, and a article there written by William Black, who is more of a progressive economist, and William Black sort of traces this debate between Krugman and what he calls the Gang of Four. You see, all the Hillary Clinton economists, not all, but many of them, jumped on board and are supporting this Krugman view, and Black calls them the Gang of Four. Who are they? Well, there's Laura Tyson and Christina Romer of the University of California, who held positions in the previous Clinton administrations, right? Liberals. Neoliberals, excuse me, and of course Krugman and this other guy named Kruger. They're all the same ilk, and they're all have close ties, deep ties with the Democratic Party, and so they're going on the offensive as Bernie Sanders' ideas are catching hold a little bit here in the last few months, and people are finally seeing a proposal and a solution that's quite different than the neoliberal, whether Democrat or Republican neoliberal solutions, which are dead ends. And, you know, people are getting interested. You know, what is this stuff? And Bernie is getting more support, particularly by the poor millennials who are taking it in on the chin here, you know, with millennials, no wage increase. Millennials, you know, 25 to 34-year-olds in this country, I forgot to mention, are making the same real wage that they were in 1984. 30 years later, they're making the same pay, millennials. You know, they're loaded up with debt, and they can't find real-time, full-time jobs, right? And if you're a millennial without a college education, you're making less than you were in 1984. Okay, so millennials are, that's the big news. And no wonder the millennials, the young people, are supporting Bernie Sanders. You know, they're the ones that are becoming, quote, radicalized most, because they're the ones under the greatest pressure. Makes sense. You know, just human nature. So anyway, getting back to this debate in financial transaction tax, what we see is this this assault by the Gang of Four, led by Krugman, attacking Bernie Sanders through this guy Friedman, who just made an attempt to show, based upon even Krugman's models, how Sanders' proposals would have a major positive effect for everybody on the U.S. economy. Well, Krugman, you know, talks and says, well, Bernie Sanders is in fantasy land. That's an economic analysis, isn't it? Fantasy land. Okay. But anyway, big attack, and that will continue here. Maybe it will subside once the previously ordained decision to give Hillary Clinton the candidacy actually occurs here, not too distant future. It'll be interesting to see what the Sanders supporters do. I predict that the young, the millennials, 25-34, especially those supporting Sanders, will not support Hillary Clinton in a general election. They will sit home. They will not vote. They will be so disgusted. And that's a big, big risk for Hillary's campaign when they get to the general election. Because minorities, you know, ethnic minorities, particularly Latin people, have been promised a lot under Obama and nothing delivered for them. And we're going to, you know, the black clergy and the black middle class will support Hillary, but will actual average black workers turn out? Of course, their numbers are less than Hispanic workers in this country. And will young people turn out? And if you look at the elections in 2012, 2014, it was the young vote, massive in 2008, of course, gave Obama massive majorities, but those majorities began to disappear. 2010, they didn't turn out. 2012, they thought, well, one more time, let's see. He, Obama's making promises whether it's going to work, and they kind of returned a little bit, but when it's clear he wasn't doing anything in 2014, they disappeared. And I don't think they're going to come back, you see. We have a revolution of sorts going on within the political parties in the U.S. We all know that. Even on the right, we got this populism, people falling, young people and others falling behind supporting Trump, because Trump has a different message than the Cruises and the Bushes and all the others. You know, Donald Trump, maybe he's lying, probably is, but he's saying some appealing things. You know, he's attacking free trade. He's talking about, he's not attacking health care reform. His tax proposals are tax cuts across the board more than the others instead of just the rich. No wonder the Republican establishment is very nervous about this guy. At least what he's saying, you know, is not traditional pro-corporate Republican stuff. And that's his appeal. He is particularly appealing to the white working class, who have been really abused over the last 8-10 years. And he's getting, and it doesn't matter what the elites say about him. You know, folks sense something different. Now, it may be just total pandering on his part, Trump's part, because he's a billionaire after all. And I don't trust billionaires to be anything but billionaires. So, you know, he may be lying, but it's effective lying. And he's getting a lot of support, and his positions are scaring the hell out of the Republican establishment. That's why I believe that they will do everything they can, obviously, to stop his candidacy. And I'm going to predict here, watch out. If there's a contested election, a primary nomination, contested nomination on the Republican side, You know who it's going to be? Watch out. It may be Paul Ryan. Yes, Paul Ryan may come out the party's candidate here in the election, should it occur. The nomination, Republican nomination, and Trump doesn't get it on the first round. I think Trump will then run as an independent, you see. And then we're going to have this interesting thing for the next 2 to 4 years of populism denied on the right and populism denied on the left. And what we may get is some sort of new party alignment. Anyway, we'll watch that closely. But let's go back to the financial transaction tax, right? And funding of national health care. All of these models and all of these ivory tower debates are irrelevant because they use old, worn-out models. Let me just give you some facts here. Other advanced economies, I'm talking about single-payer universal health care, Medicare for all. Other advanced economies in the world, all the others in Europe, Canada, Japan, and so forth, spend about 9 to 11% of their GDP on health care. We spent 17-18%. Okay, if we spent, by the way, of the GDP of the U.S. is $18 trillion, and we spend 17%, you know, that's roughly $3 trillion. $3 trillion is what we spend on health care. $3 trillion of $18 trillion GDP is spent on health care. But if we spent the 9 to 11%, let's say 10%, that Europe and Japan and Canada and the other advanced economies spend on their health care, right, it would cost us not $3 trillion, but $1.8 trillion. We would save, by going to Medicare for All, we would save $1.2 trillion every year. That if we spent $10 trillion. I mean, if we make the simple assumption that if they could do it at 10%, Medicare for All, we could do it for 10%. I'm going to make that assumption. Well, where is this other $1.2 trillion going? If we spend $3 trillion and it would only cost us $1.8 trillion if we spent 10% of our GDP, where's the other $1.2 trillion going? I'll tell you where. It's going to the paper pushers. It's going to health insurance companies who don't deliver one iota of health care services. Yes, we are subsidizing insurance companies and middlemen $1.2 trillion a year every year. Right? So we could do it for $1.8 trillion. I mean, forget all these convoluted models and arguments and so forth. Historically, if they can do it for 10%, we should be able to do it for 10% and save ourselves $1.2 trillion. So you would need to raise $1.8 trillion to pay for single-payer health care, national health care in this country. All right, so how could you raise $1.8 trillion? You could raise that and far more from just the financial transaction tax. I'm not talking about closing all these loopholes on multinational corporations and tax inversions and all this tax avoidance and tax fraud that's going on with these big companies. Forget, put even that aside. Let's just talk about funding it from the financial transaction tax. Could we raise that $1.8 trillion? And the answer is easily, easily. Let's take another benchmark. We had a study in Europe, European Commission, a couple of years ago, that indicated if they had a 0.1% tax on stocks and bonds, and a 0.01% of a tax on financial derivatives, in just 11 countries in Europe, which is about two-thirds of the size of the U.S. economy, they would raise $47 billion. In other words, a 0.01% tax on derivative sales and a 0.1% tax on stock and bond sales would raise $47 billion. And that's two-thirds the size of the U.S. Well, if you roll that up and say, okay, an equivalent size, the U.S., we would raise, with that kind of a minimal tax, $70 billion a year. With a 0.1% stock and bond tax and derivatives, or even less, $70 billion a year. Okay, now, 0.1% tax on stocks and bonds is ridiculously low. I mean, come on, we spend 8% sales tax. When we go buy food, why shouldn't these investors pay 7, 8, 10% sales tax when they buy things like stocks and bonds? Why not? Well, okay, let's say 10% is too much. Let's say 5%. Let's take half of that, a sales tax of 5% on stocks and bonds. How much would that raise annually in the U.S.? Over $3 trillion. And I haven't even added the tax on derivatives. Let's say we tax derivatives at 1%. How much more would we add? Right. Well, we would add close to another $1 trillion, even just derivative sales in the U.S. And what about taxes on foreign exchange, like the Chinese are about to do? Foreign exchange, a 1% tax on retail foreign exchange, not central bank to central bank buying, but just on retail. Well, if you look at the Bank of International Settlements, their last survey in 2013, there's $5 trillion of buying of currencies every day. Every day. Okay, so let's just take the U.S. share. Let's say it's half of that. Okay, half of that. So if you tax $2.7 trillion every day at one-tenth of 1%, you know, you would be adding hundreds of billions of dollars more in taxes. So just by taxing 5% stocks and bonds, 1% on derivatives in the U.S., and 1% on just dollar to other currency exchanges in the U.S., my estimate is you would raise $3.9 trillion. Now, that's twice as much as the $1.8 trillion that would be needed to fund annually health care for everybody under 65. And that would leave more than $1 trillion to improve Social Security for those over 65. And you would still have money left over. In other words, a financial transaction tax, a real one, will raise so much money that you could fund health care totally in this country and have money left over for other social needs as well. Okay, so that's my contribution to this debate, an ivory tower debate among economists on Sanders' proposals. It's just a toe in the water for Sanders, and we should be adding even more. Okay, that's it for today. Jack Rasmus, Alternative Visions.